Hello. What am I doing looking over there? I'm looking down here at the camera. So, what I was going to say is, hello. Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. Of course, it's going to depend on when and where you're listening to this. Anyhow, if you're watching the video, you're seeing the back of a lot of stuff. That's because I'm using a different camera. Just using this kind of a nice webcam that I've got set up. Hopefully the image is good, but hopefully the audio out of this thing is coming through loud and clear. So, you know, I love bread. Not money, but I love money, bread. But bread. So I stopped eating bread because of all the carbs and all that kind of stuff. There's a whole nother story to that. But how many of you out there have stopped eating something and then you go back to eating it? Because that's what I did. I picked up a loaf of my favorite sourdough. Just love sourdough. Toasted sourdough. Not toasted, but just smothered in butter. So I had a slice. It tastes so good. I felt like I got a stomachache. Didn't think much of it. Thought maybe it was the strawberry preserve, the sugar-free. Then the next day, I had another slice. Actually, I had two. Stomach kind of felt the same. Day three, I thought, you know what? I'm going to have another one or two slices. I did, and guess what? Yep, you got it. Tummy ache. So what I want to know is how many of you out there used to eat a lot of the, whatever it was or was, and you stopped, and then you went back to it, and then all of a sudden you're going, God, I don't feel that good eating this. Have you had that experience? Are you going to stop? Are you going to keep eating it? Well, I'm not going to let that expensive loaf of sourdough bread go to waste. So me, I'm going to eat it all. I may not buy another loaf, but I'm eating this one. There you go. That's my chit chat for right now. Hey, today's guest is really great. He's a fantastic guy. He's a well-known actor. In fact, you might recognize his voice or you might recognize his face. But if you don't, He was in a lot of shows. He was in Babylon 5. He's a bunch of police shows. What was it? The Next Generation of Love Boat or something like that. But we talk a little bit about his acting career. Not much. But the important thing is we have a discussion about caregiving for your mom, his mom. So his story really is about taking care of his mother. And his memoir is called A Cup of Tea on the Commode. So I hope you enjoy this conversation that I'm having with Mark. And, you know, please share it. Please like. And please leave comments. If you're ready, let's get right to it. Before we really get into the meat of the story, what we're here to talk about, because it's really important. But I wanted to ask you, because you were born in Jersey, you are East Coast, you went to the West Coast, you became an actor, and you've been in quite a number of television shows up until like the 2010-ish, so you're in like the Law and Order.
I think 2012 was the last, I did a movie of the week, but I saved a 17-year-old girl from prison, so I ended on a good note, and then I did a play, I think, in 2012, and that was the last I think official thing I did in Hollywood, and then.
Okay.
But the timing was great because I went to this whole thing with my mom started in 2011, and those other things must have ended before this because I didn't do any acting after the story with my mom. So so that happened in February, started in February of 2011, and. I was kind of retired anyway because you, men and women, you both age out. So at that point, I was in my mid-50s and not much was happening. And most of my time was spent in the snack food company, which was crazy.
But, well, you've had quite the notable life. I was going to say again, you know, Hill Street Blues, Dynasty, Webster, Babylon 5. For those out there into sci-fi stuff, you're in all.
Well, you've
of
done
that.
A dive. Yeah, it's like holy crap. Yeah, there's a. Well, my goal was the Hill Street Blues. I was in Ohio at the time. I went to school at Ohio State University, so I took a slow move west. And I was working for a really good design firm, But the acting bug bit. We were all performers as kids in the ballet, and then you get to a point where I wanted to be a doctor, and that's why I went to Ohio State. But that acting bug was always in me, and I think that I always I like an adventure. So I had a great design job with one of the best design firms in the country. And I gave it up to go out and become an unemployed actor for a long time. But I went out and I studied. I said I wanted to be a good actor. I didn't want to be a flash in the pan. And my goal was to get on Hill Street Blues. And so in 2 years later, I was on Hill Street Blues. So that was pretty cool.
Wow. That's setting goals and achieving. So that's great.
Yeah, I guess, yeah. Yeah.
But, you know, the important thing is... you knew when it was time to leave things behind and go back to your roots and your family and your mother and really help her out. So yeah. You wrote a memoir, and to me, it's really more than just a memoir because you interview people and you talk to people and you hear them say memoir, and it's really just a story talking about what they did kind of thing. And your book is, your memoir is something that each and every single one of us will experience at one time or another, some sooner than others. But, you know, your memoir is called A Cup of Tea on the Commode. And it's about you really being with your mother and helping your mother at the end of her story, her life. Can you pick it up from there?
Yeah, so, how all this transpired? February of 2011, I get a phone call from my oldest brother, and he said, "Mom just shut down." I carried her limp body into the house because she was at she went to a senior center 5 days a week for some activities, and so she was at the senior center, and apparently she just went to sleep and wouldn't respond, and. They called up. It wasn't like an emergency. She was still breathing and stuff. So they didn't call an ambulance. They called my brother and said, "Come get your mother." So he said he was very upset. And he says, "I carried her limp body in the house and put her to bed and called the doctor." And the doctor said, "Cut off all meds, all food and liquids and let her go." Doctor didn't even call. I mean, didn't know any details. Certainly didn't come over to see his patient. Just said, "Let her die and call hospice." So the hospice came, and I kind of freaked out because 14 years earlier, my dad was not doing well, but I was there with him, and we didn't call hospice to the till the last minute, basically, because we were taking care of him and he was fine. But still, when hospice came, he died 2 days later. So when I hear hospice, I think, oh, you know, this is not good. So I flew home as quickly as I could, and she was laying in bed, no response really, and we were on death watch, and she was Catholic. We all grew up Catholic, so we had a priest come in and do the deliver the last rites, and we had people living in the house that had been there for about 3.5 years, and they were supposed to take care of laundry and maintaining the house and feeding my mom and keeping her company. And they ended up really not doing much. And they took advantage of a beautiful home in a really nice town with a great education system. They had a little a kid. There was three generations. So it was a grandmother, the daughter, and then they had at that point, he was about a five-year-old kid. And so he had a great school to go to. And they stopped doing all kinds of stuff for my mother. Our house that I grew up in and was in our family for over six decades at that point was no longer our home. It was their home. And my mother was kind of sequestered in her bedroom with all anything that was part of the Porro family was all shoved into this room. And my mother was depressed. And I think this was a cry for help. She was not happy. She had some depression issues over the years, but this was a big deal. So she needed to be rescued. And so when I went back there, you know, you're kind of on death watch, but I started looking at the environment and the people who were dealing with her. And I said, boy, you know, I'd want to check out of this life too. This is terrible. She was a prisoner in her own home. So I stayed there for a few months. But before that, after a number of weeks, hospice would come in and they had the directive, no, only ice chips for some relief and to keep the tongue moist, but no food, none of the, you know, and this is the directive from the supervisors. So we obeyed that and we expected all the hospice nurses, you know, you have hospice going there for a number of months. So they're constantly changing and sending new nurses. So we would meet them at the front door, show them the directive, and they would read it, and then they would go in and take care of mom. Well, this one, we call her the rebel, reads the directive, goes into my mother's bedroom. My mother's eyes are closed, and she's in the same state she's been in for a number of weeks. And she leans in and says, "Are you hungry?" And my mother's eyes snapped open for the first time in weeks. And then this woman started accusing us of starving our mother to death. It's like, wait a minute, this is the directive. We didn't make up these rules. We thought, you know, anyway. So she went and called her supervisor, and the supervisor said, "Listen, you broke the rules. Leave right now. We're going to send another nurse in." In the meantime, I'm thinking, wait a minute, maybe we are starving our mother. This is terrible. So now the guilt is filled me up with guilt. So I go into my mom and I said, "Mom, are you hungry?" And she talked for the first time in weeks. And she said, "Yes." And I said, "What do you want?" And she says, "What do you got?" I said, "Anything you want. So what is it?" And she says, "How about some pumpkin pie?" And it's March. And it's not exactly pumpkin pie season. So my older brother was there, and I said, "Mike, go find some pumpkin pies." He went out, and by some small miracle, he found two pumpkin pies. And he comes back, and we gave my mom a slice, and the first thing she spit out, because it was the first food in weeks, and we said, "Well, that's not going so well." And then we tried again, and she ended up eating half the pumpkin pie. And then the next day she finished off the rest of them. So she ate two pumpkin pies.
Wow.
And she was awake and alert and on no meds. She was probably on a dozen medications at that point. And she was a type 2 diabetic. So she moved from pumpkin pie to bowls of sherbet, 8 bowls of sherbet a day. Ooh. That's all she wanted. And we said, "You're awake, you're alive, you get whatever you want." And she was in great shape.
Can we establish a mom's age as well?
Yeah,
so
she was 80. She just turned 89.
Okay, and then I just want to ask, because you had mentioned that people were living in the house, but you did like house cleaning, and you kind of said, "Hey, time for you guys to get out of there," right? Or when did that happen?
Well, unfortunately, yes, that would be the desire, but these people were in there for a long time. And my brother, who hired them, was still supporting them.
Okay,
so
gotcha.
I have a chapter in a book called My Brother Teresa. And my brother had a habit of hiring anybody, qualified or not, because they were desperate for a job. So he's a good guy, but he can do that at work, but not when you have your mother's life in their hands. And unfortunately, fortunately for us, so fresh eyes would come in and we would notice the tension in the house. And my mother did not like these people, and these people did not like my mother. That became very clear over time. But I could not get rid of them for a number of months because of, apparently we have a lawyer. Our next door neighbor was our lawyer. And I talked to him, and he said, because of Jersey law, one of the grandmother was over 60, and they were in that house long enough to establish some kind of, I guess, residency, so I couldn't get rid of it. Now, this is Jersey, and I'm an Italian. So I could have taken some other options, but we came up with a compromise because I had to also appease my brother who hired these people. So I had to be careful. So we came up with a compromise. So they stayed in the house another 6 months. And that added a lot of tension to the house. But I was taking care of my mom, and then hospice was there. I didn't move in yet because I still had commitments in Los Angeles. So I stayed there probably till May. And then hospice was going to be there till at least June. So I felt comfortable with hospice there. But the same people that kind of drove my mother to this, I think I called it a death wish, were going to be around for a while. Okay. And so then I didn't move in permanently until December of that year. But I came back in September and took over again of all the duties. And I mean, all of them. I learned a lot from hospice. That was, I was a good student. So actually my younger sister and I both hung out with hospice the whole time they were there. So we learned all the tips and tricks of how to take care of a patient. And though it's rare for a son, I guess, to take over the caregiving, I jumped in. I loved it, actually. And I learned, and there was no line that I didn't, I mean, I did everything for my mother. And there's some things in the book where maybe went a little too far, but it was necessary to do that. And I worked with hospice on these things. And you do what you got to do. And she was happy. And I asked her, I made sure she wanted me to come back. And I said, I want to take care of you. And make sure you've got everything you need and you're treated like a queen. Do you want me to come back? She said, yes. And I said, okay, done. So I worked out. I went back to L.A., worked everything out where I could come back, take care of my mom. And every other month, I would fly back to L.A. to take care of some stuff in the snack business. But a lot of that stuff could be done remotely.
I'm going to apologize and say... I hope you don't mind me jumping in and asking certain questions, because I know that this, like I said, this is something that everybody is going to experience at some point in time in their life. And there are certain things I think are important aside from, you know, the memoir. But I think your memoir is going to shed some light definitely on the experience, what to possibly expect. And I've been through the same situation that you had, but with my father. And, you know, I had siblings too. So one of the questions that I would have for you is, you have other siblings, which probably were a little bit closer to Jersey than what you were initially. Yep. What was it that really prompted you and maybe did more than the other siblings? Was it just because of your undying love for your mom, or was there other dynamics in there? And I hope you don't mind me asking that.
Well, I had a different relationship with both of my parents. I was a very curious guy, and I liked family history, and I liked also documenting family history. Mm. And so I asked them a lot of questions, and they didn't have a great marriage. There was a lot of tension growing up, because they had a Catholic marriage, Catholic couple. They were going to stay together till death till they part, no matter how miserable they may or may not have been. But when they traveled outside of the home, and usually separate vacations, I got to know them very well, because they would come out and see me in California. I had them for a week or so by myself, and I would ask questions. And since I was an actor and a writer, I would write things. I wrote a really kind of revealing monologue about my dad that I used, because it was easy to tap into the emotion. So it was great for auditions for me. But I, one of the trips he came out, I let him read it, because it was, he had a tough relationship, a very strained relationship with my younger sister, who was my best friend and a really good kid. But I think she was born when there was no love left in the marriage. So he thought my mom spoiled her. And she may have, because, you know, dad wasn't really into her. And so this monologue kind of reveals all that stuff. And so he read this thing. My dad was a pretty shy guy. He was very charming and stuff. Again, outside the house, where they had no tension. In the house, both of them were a little different. But outside the house, both were very funny, very charming people. But when he read this monologue, he was absolutely dead silent. And I'm like, oh my God, what have I done? And he, and then we talked, and he opened up about stuff. It was amazing. He told me about his honeymoon, the marriage, the questions he had, the problems he had from the very beginning. And I got to know him as a man, not my dad, and not the cranky husband, and to realize that it takes two So my mom, you know, was the one, my dad, let's say, would bark and complain about money and stuff quite a bit, but it takes two. And so, and then with my mom, I think I became overprotective of my mom because of that tension in the house. But I talked to both. I mean, when we had the sex talk, it was me giving the sex talk to my dad. He never gave me the sex talk. And when we had this thing talking about my mom and his problem, I said, do you think you were a good lover? And who asked their father this? And especially my father was, I think, 42 years older than me. So he was, you know, middle-aged almost when he had me. And we're talking, you know, man to man, and it was great. And it was amazing to get him to do that. And then with my mom, same thing. We talked about everything. And a lot of it's revealed in the book. And because of that relationship, I had, I think it made it easier for me to jump in. Now, my older brother would do a lot of the stuff for my mother, but he was not as gentle as I would watch it and go, oh my God, you know, when you're rolling her over to change her diaper, she's doing a face plant in the railing of the bed. And he's not even concerned, but I see my mother's face and, you know, I'm like, oh my God. So I was very gentle and tried to be very conscious of the patient. My oldest sister had a time limit with my mom that she readily admitted to. She said, 7 days and I'm going to blow my top. So she did it when she would come back. When I went to L.A., we would switch. So she would come and take care of my mom while I was in L.A. doing the snacks. And but she found no joy in it. And she did it as a dutiful daughter, but she did the work and found no joy or maybe no love. And it was weird. My little sister would come in, but she had five children and a husband in Michigan. So she would come in and help out. And she was great, but her time was limited because she had her own responsibilities. Yeah. I had, you know, it's a choice, I guess. So the two middle kids, I say they were pretty much hands off, but they helped in other ways. Carol would cook a lot. She lived at the Jersey Shore, so when she come up, she would make blankets, handmade blankets for my mom, some nice little treats, and bring soup or something like that. David took care of the garden and mowed the lawn and snow plowed in the winter and things like that, but nothing hands-on with mom. So kind of left it up to me. We all have a pretty good sense of humor, and so humor played a big role in it. So I had a lot of fun because she had some visions, some pretty crazy visions in the beginning. And also, out of her, one day, I thought she was kidding because you couldn't tell if she, you know, she had a little bit of dementia and ended up where a doctor did test a couple of years later and said, yes, she has a little bit of Alzheimer's as well. But I came into her bedroom and I was taking care of her, feeding her juice first thing in the morning. And she says, now, what is it I call you? And I go, what, are you kidding? She goes, no. And I said, well, name your kids. And she named everybody but me. Oh. Rattled them off. Laurel, Michael, Carol, David, boom. And I'm like, wait a minute. And she goes, and I said, Mark. And she says, Mark. Mark with a K? I said, yes, Mark with a K, your favorite son. And she says, I don't have favorites. I said, well, you have a favorite to forget. So I have a chapter in the book where I talk about that. And I said, I think wiping a loved one's butt causes amnesia. And I have evidence to prove my point, because she never forgot any other child but mine. And then at one time we got my brother's old girlfriend, who she hasn't heard from or talked about or heard about in probably 50 years, found out I was taking care of mom. And I didn't know how close they were, but apparently they were very close. And so she wanted to write a letter to my mother. And I said, I'll read it to her because I'm not sure if she can read it, but I'm sure she would be glad to hear from you. And so I asked mom, I said, Mom, do you remember Kathy? She goes, oh, yes, I remember Kathy. I go, why? Because she doesn't wipe your butt. So.
Oh,
But you have to laugh. I mean, you know, it would be easy to get hurt or you let your ego. It's like, no, this is fine. And then it got to a point where she didn't forget me. But I did have to tape my name on the ceiling in very bold, large letters. So when I would go into her bedroom, she'd be lying in bed, and I'd go and I'd say, good morning. And she said, good morning, Mark. So the visual aid definitely helped.
And you know, you're so right that you have to take things lightly. Sometimes, like you said, slight dementia may set in with some folks, but you can't take things personal as the caregiver. At least that's what I've experienced as well. Yeah. They may get angry, they may get angry at you, but it's, you know, I just told myself then don't take it personal.
Yeah, you can't. And also, it wasn't all a smooth ride. I got angry at her a few times because she was very stubborn, and sometimes she just wouldn't eat. And I would, but boy, she was good. They say that Jewish mothers invented guilt. Catholic mothers perfected it, and she was good. So there was one day, she just wouldn't eat. And I got really, I said, listen, I do all the cooking, the cleaning, the wiping, the changing the diapers, the shopping, everything. You need to eat and you need to appreciate the meal that's in front of you. Cooked with love. And she just absolutely refused. Wow. So I turned off the lights in the kitchen and went down and did some laundry and assaulted a very innocent washing machine, apparently, and came back into the kitchen, and I turned on the kitchen light. Oh, my God. And this woman was sitting in the dark. She ate her meal, and her knife and fork were on the plate, and her hands were in her lap. And I mean, you know those things where the parent says, this will hurt more than me, or this will hurt me more than you? Mm-hmm. She did it. It hurt me more than it hurt her, and I was just flabbergasted. So I just leaned in and said, thank you. And so there's lovely moments like that came out of something not so pretty on my part, certainly. But, you know, certain things rear their ugly head. If you can head them off at the pass, I guess that's great. But there's you got to deal with the stress and the strain and the emotional stress and the toll it takes. So one of the main things you have to do as a caregiver is you have to take breaks. You have to take care of yourself. And that's something that I didn't learn until my mother almost outlived me. I had to go through three emergency surgeries for a stretch of 8 months. And I would say most of that was stress from the people I had to live with for 6 months. And not so much my mom, but I'm sure that took a toll as well. And so I learned the lesson. The pros say you got to take a break. You got to give yourself a break and stuff like that. So after that, I certainly had to be a little more conscious of that. So
yeah, and that's so important too, because you know, you are at the end of the life of your parent that you're taking care of, and the worst thing I think that could happen is you let it go on a sour note, if you know what I mean. And because at that time, there's no taking it back, there's no fixing, none of that. I think taking that break is very important, and to get yourself centered again and walk back in with a smile and just keep going. So, you know, you're talking about the pies and all this sherbet kind of stuff, the sweets that your mom started really craving. Was there a point in time when you thought, oh my gosh, she's going to make it. She's coming through. This is great. I don't have to be here anymore. Or was it just one of those slow rides where you're like, well, I know it's going to happen. And she's just, you know.
Yeah, you have to. I talk about it, I guess, in my story. So I have, I don't know if it's a commitment issue or what, but I I like adventure. So, like, I gave up a really good design career to try this crazy acting thing. And I did pretty well with it for a while, but then I started a snack food business to go up against the big guys. I've tried a greeting card company for a while. So I like adventure, but this one was different. So I knew, and that's the realization you have to come to. You have to say, okay, I'm going to stick with this one till the end. Mom will make the decision, but I am here until. So it was, you have to know at that point or accept it that I'm in here till the end. And so that's it. So it's like I was not a parent and I'd never been married. And so this was my first child. Mm-hmm. So it was interesting. But I mean, beautiful in a way, because I think that both of my parents died in their bed, in their bedroom, and I was with both of them, and different siblings were with me, one sister with dad and one sister with mom. But it's a tough thing to go through, but I wouldn't have missed it for the world, because I wanted them to know. And both mom and dad, I said, you know, if they open their eyes, they're going to see a smiling face. And that's the most important thing. And also, what you mentioned about regrets and stuff, I think with both of my parents, I don't think I left anything unsaid. We talked about everything. And my dad was more talkative, and he was certainly sharper to the end. My mother, kind of slow, got slower and slower and less, spoke less and less, and was awake less and less, and things like that. My dad went relatively quickly. Mm-hmm. Still, when I knew she was checking out, I said, I'm not leaving her side. So the last couple chapters are pretty, I think tells that whole story, because I've had a few reviewers say he's unflinching in this whole thing, but it was beautiful.
Well, so, that's perfect time again to remind people of your memoir. It's called A Cup of Tea on the Commode. And you can go to your website. Yes, there it is.
And it's on Amazon and a lot of other online retailers, but Amazon is your best bet, I think. And it comes in large print, ebook, and paperback. I'm going to try to do the audio book at some point, but boy, it's hard. All my acting training is going to have to kick in, because it's I've done a few chapters, and boy, it's difficult to get through it without breaking down. But
Fly on out here. I've got a vocal booth right here that you can use free of charge.
Great. Okay. And where are you located?
Yeah, I'm on the east, or I'm on the west coast up in Washington State. So
okay. All right.
It would have been better off if you were in LA area still. You know, my hopes with this, where people are watching and listening in and go and get your memoir, your book, is that they come to the realization how short life is, how important life is, how important your mother and your father are, and to spend, you know, every moment of the time, day that you can with them. And, you know, kind of like what we were talking about here is, you know, if you know that it's coming toward the end, try not to make waves. Try not to make things, I think, tough on them, because it's also going to be tough on you. Like we're saying, regrets and things like that. I definitely know that you don't want to have any of that.
Right.
So I'm going to say thank you for sharing those experiences with us. Moving fast forward with your mother, when she was ready to go, how did you prepare yourself when you said, you know what, mom is letting me know there's only days left? What did you do for yourself? I mean, how did you prepare for that?
Well, at that point, because of my medical issues. We had a caregiver who did the heavy lifting. So it was a lady by the name of Marina, and she was lovely. But I had to go out to LA for a couple of weeks and to tie up things with the snack food company. So my sister came back for those 2 weeks, and that was well over her 7-day limit. So I was a little concerned. But when I came back, she was a different person, and I knew she was going. She had a foot, her right foot would tap. She didn't talk anymore. I don't think there was another word out of her. But you could tell she was just shutting down. And Marina was a well-experienced nurse's aide, so she kind of knew as well. But this foot would tap to like a music that nobody heard, and it was hysterical. And Marina and I would constantly crack up because she wouldn't say a word, but the foot would go. We said, maybe that the whole point of this is she's entertaining us. She wants us to laugh and lighten up the mood, and it was great. I know from my dad there is certain signs that death is imminent. And when that started, we put her to bed, and she no longer left the bed. I think the last time on the commode, she had a pain in her stomach. And that was rare, that she was a tough woman, so she rarely mentioned or complained about pain. But this must have been something. And so that was the last time that she left the bed. And so I knew it was happening, so we called a Catholic priest again. Mm-hmm. And now she's out, and her eyes are closed, and she isn't spoken. Catholic priest comes in, steps into her bedroom. She wakes right up, and I look at her, and she says, "Hello." And this guy is expecting a person near death, and she's wide awake now. And I said, "Mom, if you stand up, I will kill you myself." And the priest was laughing and laughing. Anyway, he did a beautiful last rites, and as soon as he left, boom, she's out again. And that was pretty much it. She lasted, I said that, you know, she seemed to want to leave this life pretty quickly, but she took her time doing it because it was about 5 days. And once I knew she was going, I told Marina, "I'm taking over. I'll need your help in the mornings and stuff, but I will be holding my mom's hand all night long and giving her whatever she wanted." And once in a while, she'd open her eyes, and I wanted to make sure that when she did, that again, she'd see a smiling face. And it's tough, but it was great because at one point, I asked her if she wanted coffee ice cream was her favorite. And so I asked her if she wanted some coffee ice cream, and she just, so great. So I fed her just a couple of spoonfuls before she passed out again. Yeah. But it was lovely to be able to serve her like that. And then when hospice comes, we had to call hospice again. They give you a white box with a number of things in there, including morphine. And morphine in a syringe where you could squirt it under the tongue. And so before giving that to my mother, I tested it. And it's horrible. It tastes terrible. I wonder why. Now I know why people shoot up, because it's terrible. Anyway, so we went through that pretty quickly, which I was very surprised. But my mom did feel some pain for the first time and admitted it. And so we did the morphine. And I joked about, I kept a few extras for me. But, she kept needing it. So I said, "Boy, my supply is going to be gone soon." So I would call up hospice and go, Can we get any extra here? Because it's going pretty fast. So it was no sleep for about 5 days. Yeah. And she did wake up at one point and look at me, and she mouthed, "I love you," which was beautiful. I couldn't hear it, but I could see the and so she knew I was there. And she knew that she was, well-loved and stuff. And so that was... that was nice. That was a nice confirmation that I'm doing a good job.
Mark, if there's anything that you could say to people out there that are currently going through this or expecting to go through it very shortly, what would you advise them to do? How to prepare themselves, or, you know, do they repair what they have with their siblings so they can stand in front of mom and dad and, you know, be a happy family? Or what would you say to everybody out there?
It's tough. I think, well, the main thing, let's say with the parent, we'll talk about the siblings in a minute. Mm-hmm. Just be there. Be there. You have to put yourself in their shoes. So empathy is huge. It's their time at their pace. And if you can give them anything they want, please do that. And you know, my mother was Irish, so I played a lot of Irish music in those last 5 days. And early on, I did the river dance one time to get her to smile, because my goal was to get her to laugh at least once every day. So one day she was not feeling particularly happy, so I did a river dance, which made her laugh, but my shins cry. So there's sacrifices you got to make, but. I think the most important thing is to be there and be there full of love. And they sense it. Also, I think the hearing is the last sense to go. So they you know, whether they're on their way out or not, keep talking. Mm-hmm. I kept talking to her, telling her stories. And the music was, you know, there too when I couldn't talk anymore. But they know. And also touch. I held her hand. Most of the time, and then my brother came over one night, and so he held, you know, her right hand, I held her left hand, and one of her grandchildren came for a couple of nights, and he did the same. So she knew that we were there, and so that's the main thing. The sibling thing, my siblings were great. They entrusted me. I think they knew that I was going to be fine with it, and I think they knew that Mom and I were really close, but they backed off, and a couple of them even asked, you know, when can I come over? And I said, this is your house too, but they were very respectful, and so that was great, and I really appreciated their support. And then the grandchildren were great also. And once those people left the house, I ended up renovating the entire house because my mom was sleeping a lot. So I had some time to do that. And so I wanted to return not only dignity to her, but to her environment. And so once we redid the house, the grandkids started coming back and staying over, because it was a beautiful, welcoming home again. And we started having a holiday dinner. So we had Christmas dinner there, and we had Easter dinner there, and Thanksgiving dinner back at the house with us in the dining room, like we did as kids. And those were very special moments for my mom. Birthdays, so we had three more birthdays with my mom. One was a big one when she finally came back, so that was her 90th. Was a big one. So we had that at my brother and sister-in-law had a dance studio. So we had like 20, 25 of us there. The rest of them were more intimate family gatherings like we did in our childhood. Mm. And it was beautiful. It was beautiful. So it's their time. You make the sacrifices because, you know, they put up with us for at least 18 years, some a lot longer.
Right.
We got to do what we got to do to send them off in a beautiful way. I mean, both parents had a great way to leave the earth. So,
you know, one thing that I want to add for everybody that's listening to the program right now is you had mentioned that, you know, one of the last senses to go, you're guessing, is their hearing. So talk to them. So what I'm getting at is, with us, the living, the people that are left behind, I think one of the first things that we forget, not true all the time, but I think one of the first things that we forget is the sound of their voice. We have pictures and we see their faces. We can mimic what W.C. Fields sounds like, or how he talked, or Clark Gable and things like that. But when you say, well, what does your dad sound like? Where's your mom? It's like, I can hear it in my head distant, but I can't get it out. So I always say, make time to, like you did, ask questions and record it, kind of a memory of your parents before they actually go. And don't wait till the last second when they're going through dementia and they might say, oh, yeah, I remember when I went to the moon. Remember that?
Yeah.
You're like, Dad, you never went there. Oh, yes, I did. Yeah. But I think to me that's an important thing, is being able to hear their voice.
Yeah.
So, yeah. But I want to say thank you very much for really sharing some of the chapters and your experiences in your memoir. And again, I just hope people really pick this up, read it, and do some of the things that you did. Read into it their story, how you went through it, is what I would
have to say. Yeah, I'm hoping it inspires people.
Yeah.
Especially men, because we don't step up as often as our as the women and our sisters and stuff. So, it's a beautiful experience. And while I was doing it, I had some friends going through something similar. So I just kind of coached them along, and that's when I knew that the because I didn't know, I took a lot of notes and videos and photographs during this journey, and I didn't know what I was going to do with it, because my background is screenwriting and that kind of stuff. So I thought maybe it'll be a movie or whatever form it took.
Yeah.
But as I talked to more and more people about my experience, it seemed like, well, this is a book seems to be the best way to get it out there,
yeah,
quicker way. Well, I had certainly more control over the content as opposed to what Hollywood could do to it. The response I'm getting from people, some people that I know, other people that are absolute strangers, just are really enjoying the book. Maybe they're getting some ideas, I don't know, but if nothing else, I mean, it's certainly entertaining too, because they were a lot of fun, and it's a great way to also keep mom and dad out there and on earth, because people are experiencing them in a whole nother way. So it's very cool.
Thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thanks, Chuck.
You're welcome.
This has been great.